This week on the show, net neutrality is kind of like grocery store marketing, cheap labor, down on the content farm, and is it hyper-local or bust? All this on This Week in Media, episode 196. Hey there, boys and girls. We are back with another edition of This Week in Media. I am your host this week, Daisy Whitney, of the New Media Minute and conference programming fame or infamy, whatever you want to call it. I have a wonderful, fabulous lineup today. We've got Alex, my co-host. He is back this week. Yay, we're reunited for a second week in a row. How are you, Alex?
I'm doing well.
How are your babies? I didn't get to ask you last week how your little daughter is doing.
She's doing great. The kids are doing great. She's on the verge of walking.
Oh. Is she one now? Did she turn one in July?
She turned one in July, and she is very. She's just become. You know, she's grown into quite a personality. She's a very demanding girl. She's not. You know, she's not. She's not going to be a low maintenance girlfriend. I'm just warning guys who are thinking about it in 15 or 20 years. She is like. She looks over at you. She doesn't cry like she's upset. She cries like she's mad.
Ooh.
You know? And so, you are not paying enough attention to me. So anyway, so she's turning into quite a little hellraiser.
Oh, fun. Yay. And we've got Tim Street, another one of our regular co-hosts. He is in – are you in L.A. today, Tim?
I am in the L.A. area today. Yes, I am. But I'm feeling like I'm in Europe. I've been getting up early to do phone calls with Europeans and I'm tired.
And of course, this is all because of your gig with M Dialogue that's keeping you busy these days.
Yeah, doing the dynamic ad insertion for the iPad and iPhone.
Very nice. And then we also have a returning guest who kind of needs no introduction, but I'm going to introduce him anyway, and that is Larry Jordan, who is a digital media guru. He does digital production buzz, and anybody who has anything to do with editing and Final Cut Pro knows about Larry Jordan. So welcome back. I didn't get to be on the other episode where you were on earlier this year, so I'm excited to be doing the show with you.
Well, it is my pleasure to join you, and Alex did a wonderful job filling in, though he could not begin to fill your high heels. I was very impressed.
I'm glad Alex doesn't wear my heels. I'm definitely glad.
I think Alex is glad, too, actually.
You know, it's hard. It's really hard on my back. I just don't have the knees for it, and so every time I try, you know, it's just like, oh, I'm not going to do this anymore.
Do you wear a bathrobe at all outside your house?
You know, I have been known to wear. I wear a bathrobe between houses. I have two. I have, you know, because we have. I have a little house that my office is in, and the big house that the family's in.
The lair. When you go back to your man lair, you wear your bathrobe.
Sometimes.
See, yeah. I'm not into. Like, we were talking about that before the show started, and I have an ironclad no bathrobe outside the house. Well, actually, I don't even have a bathrobe. Period. I just think when you get out of the shower, you put your clothes on. Like, you don't need a bathrobe.
Daisy, I think this idea of you wearing nothing outside the house has just got to stop.
Oh, stop. This conversation is going in the wrong direction. I almost always put on makeup before I walk my dog, too. Okay, that's, you know, that's... But I am 38 years old today. So I'm
38 today.
Today is my 29th for the 10th year in a row birthday.
Very happy birthday to you.
Yeah, so that's why I'm allowed to have those little standards and rules now. Like, okay, you know, no bathrobe outside the house, got to wear makeup when you're walking the dog. You get a little bit older, you got to make sure that, you know, you're always looking good when you leave. So heels, whatever it takes.
Daisy, I've seen those photographs of you on your website. You don't look a day over 21.
I have a great airbrusher. That's why. It's all because of him. But yeah, that was funny. That was a good joke. Something that is almost as exciting as heels and no clothes and bathrobes outside of the house is net neutrality, right? I mean, this is a sexy topic. Actually, it's a really important topic, and it's a complicated one. And I think it's one that a lot of people are still trying to figure out what it means. But there is a lot that's happening in this area, specifically between Google and Verizon. They announced on Monday, that would be August 9th, a proposal for how internet service should be regulated. And of course, they were immediately criticized by groups that, you know, want the network to be open as possible. It sounds as if they're saying we're on the side of net neutrality, but their proposal includes exceptions for wireless internet access and for potential new services that broadband providers could offer, things like advanced educational services, new entertainment and gaming options. I'm, you know, reading, quoting from a New York Times story that came out yesterday on this. There are so many interesting angles to this story, especially because the Times broke this about 5 days ago and was then taken to task on Twitter by Google and by Verizon, saying the story was inaccurate. And then, interestingly enough, you know, a few days later, there are some accuracies to that story. So what I want to get started with first, and Larry, I'm going to start with you since you're our guest this week, is what the heck does this mean? What are we talking about now with net neutrality? And then we'll get into some of the specifics of how will it work and favoritism and all of that stuff. But what does this mean?
Well, I think there's a couple of different issues here. The net neutrality theoretically means that everybody has equal access to the net, which is like motherhood and apple pie and chocolate chip cookies. It's a good thing. But, you know, if you look at the history of America, we have always paid extra for something that's faster or gets us in front of the line, whether it's frequent flyer miles to be able to board planes faster or toll roads to avoid traffic, or whether it's Hollywood paying for faster pipes to move movies from the one coast to the other faster. If what Google and Verizon are talking about is to provide faster access, then I don't think that's necessarily anti-American. If, on the other hand, what they're doing is they are paying extra to slow everybody else down, then that is very serious. So net neutrality is the statement that everybody has equal access with equal opportunity to all the different resources on the web. But how that gets implemented, if we look at real life or look at what's happening, if we're speeding stuff up for a fee, I think that's okay. If we're forcing everybody except us to be slowed down, that's seriously bad.
And what would Google and Verizon's role in that be? I mean, do they want to be able to offer different tiers? Is that the point of this?
Well, I was looking through 800 different articles prior to this show, from Huffington Post to New York Times and multi-channel news, and here's what I think I understand, and Tim and Alex, correct me if I'm wrong, but the New York Times reported that Google and Verizon were working on a deal to provide faster access for Google's material over Verizon's network. The New York Times article was immediately denied by both Google and Verizon. So it is both true and not true. If the article in the New York Times is true, then what they're saying is that Google is going to pay extra to Verizon to speed up Google's access to the web. Now, the FCC, who's been struggling to come up with some sort of net neutrality and finally threw in the towel last week, saying that we cannot figure out any way to make a deal at this moment, the FCC is trying to make sure that nobody is slowing someone else down. So from my perspective, based upon what I'm seeing, there's two different issues here. Google paying extra to speed their stuff up, and the FCC working to make sure that nobody pays money to slow other people down. And so far, everybody is denying everything except the FCC, which says we cannot come to any kind of an agreement. The chief of staff of the head of the FCC, a guy named Edward Lazarus, was saying that we've been having all kinds of meetings and we've been having zero conclusions being drawn.
Tim, who wins in this debate? What do you think? I mean, do you have a sense of how this might shake out?
Well, doesn't Google always win? I mean,
unless it's Google Wave.
Unless it's China and Google Wave, yeah. This scares me to death. You know who's going to lose is the consumer. I mean, that's it in a nutshell. It's really scary to me as an independent producer that somebody with more money can pay to have their content delivered faster. But yeah, that is the American way. I mean, I just bought a interstate freeway speeding pass. So now I'm allowed to do 120 miles an hour and I won't get a ticket.
I don't think that's true.
No, but Tim, can I disagree just for the sake of discussion?
Sure.
When you purchase internet access to your home, you clearly spend money with some internet provider.
Absolutely. And I can pay for a tiered, faster connection speed.
And isn't that perfectly okay?
Yeah,
that's
fine.
I don't think that's what we're talking about,
though. So it seems to me that in many cases, being able to pay for faster access has been built into when we subscribe to the internet in the first place.
Alex, what do you think?
Well, I think that one of the challenges here is it's not so much that the – I mean, so first of all, I think that the major flaw with this, of course, is that it's basically saying the FCC can't put its hands on wireless, which we know both Google and Verizon are diving deep into. And the issue with that is that we're not going to be getting our internet, 10 years from now, we're not going to be getting our internet from wired connections. So basically, this is grandfathering any impact that the FCC would have over what really will be the internet, which is going to be some kind of WiMAX or something more advanced from that. And so I think that's the biggest problem with this agreement. I think that the overall theory of the agreement is the flaw that sits inside of it is that we don't set up what a minimum level of service is. So we just say that, as long as, if we can say that, because the idea is that tiered services are fine. In fact, I want tiered services. I'm one of those people.
I pay for it.
I want, when I go to a hotel, I want to see $29 a night for internet access because it means that nobody else will be using it and I actually get a real connection. I don't want to see free, at a hotel because it means that I'll be able to maybe check my email, but that's about it. So I want tiered access as a user, and we get tiered access. We're able to, purchase those accesses. The real issue here is for the people who are on the other end of the pipe, are they going to have to pay larger access fees, or can they pay for a higher bandwidth? And it's fine for them to pay for more. I mean that in theory, but the problem is that of course development's going to go where the money goes. So if a large number of people start paying for their access to the internet, it's not that the other areas are going to necessarily be slowed down on purpose. It's just that the companies will cease to invest in the general public's access or the general, like the next new YouTube, the next company that comes out that needs a lot of bandwidth won't be able to get that bandwidth or won't be able to. It'll always be slow or
because the bandwidth, if there is a tiered pricing plan, then the best bandwidth, the fastest bandwidth will quickly be gobbled up by those who are willing to pay a lot more. So the concern is that the base level won't be performing.
And the companies won't invest in newer technologies. Right now, our internet on wireless is very slow. So they could say, we'll make sure that it never gets any slower than this, and so it'll stay that speed, and this is the time to have the argument. Admittedly, this is the time when it's at Verizon and Google's best interest to have this argument before we have wired internet that's 100 megabits a second.
Well, and the chairman of the FCC is saying that the FCC is adamantly against the whole idea of, tiered levels of internet service. So that's, and I don't know how important that stance is to the final result.
It's important to say that this is not tiered levels to the consumer because the consumer already has tiered levels. We're already paying for different speeds. What we're really talking about is access that companies will have to upload their to get to the backbone. And that's what people are concerned about is that you won't be able to have the next big thing, the next YouTube, the next whatever, Vimeo, whatever that is, that needs a lot of bandwidth, the next TV network won't
Alex,
be able to occur. Yeah.
Alex, I just had a brainstorm listening to you, and I came up with an analogy that may be useful, and that is grocery stores. If you think about the way that major grocery stores work right now, the products get placed in a grocery store are those whose distributors pay the grocery store for product placement. In terms of what products are on the end caps and what products are at eye level and what products are carried in abundance versus just one or two, it's all marketing dollars paid by the distribution system to get their products into the store to be sold.
Yeah,
and it strikes me that this is a very similar analogy to what you're suggesting, that this kind of tiered pricing would be. Is it's not that the consumer can't walk into any grocery store and buy any product that's on the shelf, but getting your product on the shelf requires payment of marketing dollars, which the consumer doesn't see, to be able to get the product in the store in the first place.
And to date, this has been something that almost anybody can do. I mean, we're really looking at this opportunity where for the next TV networks, the next, you know, whatever, they've been able to get access to this. They've been able to get access to those aisles. And so the consumers make kind of a free choice of what those are going to be. But what this has the danger of doing, of course, is cutting off, you know, and creating basically what we see in the grocery store, where we get a very limit as a consumer. We might not even have the impression that we're getting a lower quality product, but our choices are being culled out by who has the money.
Okay, I want to wrap this story with a quick show of hands. I want to know who's on Google and Verizon side, who's on FCC side.
I have both hands up.
Alex,
I'm on the FCC's.
And Tim.
I'm leaning towards the FCC, although there's one thing Alex talked about that gets my curiosity up, and that is WiMAX. I'm wondering if Google is doing this for a play to get WiMAX launched across the country so that they could give a free internet to everyone so that they can sell more ads. So that's what I'm really curious about.
Well, and I do think it's interesting. I think that it is an interesting issue is that while we're talking about people losing access to these types of things, I mean, I think one thing that Google has been good at is moving the costs from the consumer to advertisers, to providers. So one of their interests in this whole situation may be that we don't want the consumers to pay anything for the internet. And if we could charge the providers, you know, for that access to those consumers or give them a tiered price, we could actually get the consumers paying nothing. You know, for that. Now, the money has to come from somewhere, and what Google may be trying to do is refocus who pays for that.
Let's move on to another controversial story, because this is, you know, we got a lot of controversial things in the news, which is great, which makes for good fodder for discussion, and that's Demand Media. Media Post story on how Demand Media on Thursday debuted a new service for publishers to pad. I love it. That's such a simple word, but it has so many connotations. To pad their online offerings with the work of independent freelancers. The two of the first properties to employ content channels, which is what this is being called, are Hearst's sfgate.com and cron.com, CHRON. Those are obviously San Francisco publications. And now Demand Media, for those of you who are getting up to speed with Demand Media, is basically this, you know, massive content play, SEO driven, really uses algorithms and search results to figure out what type of articles to write and what type of videos, usually how-to videos, to produce, and has a farm essentially of freelancers or freelance videographers who work at a relatively low pay to go out and produce these videos. And we have talked about Demand and sort of this SEO model on previous shows, but I think it's interesting to look at whether these demand type of models are likely to become the future of web video or the future of information. I mean, here we have, you know, newspaper entities, you know, Hearst and Gannett, you know, signing up to populate their sites with content from Demand Media. Tim, what do you think?
Well, I think if you look at any great advancement in society, or any mammoth advancement, even if you go back to like the pyramids of Egypt, there's slave labor involved. And you look at YouTube. YouTube is volunteer labor. You know, we're all making these videos for free. They cost only the bandwidth charge. I mean, you know, if you've served a million videos on YouTube, somebody made some money. It was the person who charged YouTube for bandwidth. They made some money. But Demand Media is this content farm that doesn't pay very much to the labor that creates these articles, which is a great business model. And they just announced their IPO. They filed with the SEC, and they're saying that I think it's somewhere around $114 million in revenue in the first half of 2010. That's pretty good for getting people to do things for little money. So the big question, though, is when's the revolt? When does this free or cheap labor get tired and go away? And how's that going to affect all the different media companies that are using demand media's content for their sites.
And will that happen? Alex, is it inevitable that there will be a revolt by the creators of this type of, you know, low-cost content?
I think it's unlikely. I think that there's almost an unlimited supply of people who want to give their two cents. So I think that there, you know, the opportunity to do this, I think, is high enough. I mean, this is a centralized, organized thing. But when you look at, what CNN is doing with iReport, and the iReporters, it's very similar. You've seen other companies. The big problem is quality control, of being able to get people. I don't think there's much of an issue of getting people to want to provide content. And I think that there's actually an opportunity to get better content. If you have people who are actually talking about their area of expertise as opposed to reporters, the chances of them actually getting the story more correct is higher than if you just have reporters who are trying to learn something new every week to talk about. And so, I think that I've talked about this on the show in the past, but, a lot of times you read articles about things you know about and you're like, mm-hmm. These people have no idea what they're talking about. But then you assume everything else that you read in the same newspaper is true. And so because you don't know anything about it, you don't know enough to know that it's not correct. And so the thing is that there's a lot of opportunities here. I do think that the issue that they're going to have is just a lot of junk. And that's what happens in any revolution, is there's a lot of junk. You hear the same conversation every single time. When I was part of the revolution that underwound the SciTex operators. So these guys are getting paid $150 an hour, and I was doing it for $450 an hour. Using this crazy program called Photoshop in the early 90s. So the thing is that revolution happens, and suddenly everyone talks about it tearing apart the industry. And there's this mass rush for land, for railroads, for print, for all these different revolutions. There's for the Bible. When the Bible was printed, oh my gosh, people would actually be able to read it. and that was going to ruin everything. And so the thing is that this is all going to unwind and become complicated. And then out the other end, somewhere else, is going to be something that's a little bit more sane and most likely better paid. But we're probably at the beginning of that curve, and we're probably 3 to 5 years before we see that pop out the other end. And this is just one try at that.
Larry, is there room for others? I mean, do you see that there will be a lot of other demand-like folks competing in this space, and how do you see it shaking out, Larry?
Well, I want to take a step back for just a second, Daisy. Remember when you were starting out in the industry and you were brand new and either just out of school or just wanting to get your first media job? The very first words out of your mouth were, "I don't care what you pay. I just want to get a job in the industry." And that mantra has been true since television was invented back in the 1930s, is the way you get started in this industry is you work for free. And then as you start to develop skills and you find that you really do have a way to say something that people are interested in hearing, you start to charge for it. And if you're really good for it, you charge a lot. I think what demand media is doing is no different than the local television station or the local radio station or people working in Hollywood on films when they first started, is please give me a job, I'll work for free. Because that's the way the industry works. I don't think there's anything new here. Also, my background is in both broadcast and print, and what demand media is doing is exactly what syndicators have been doing since newspapers didn't have enough news stories to fill their pages, is they would go to companies that provide content cheap that they could put in a newspaper, or a local television station needs a local human interest story, and they go to syndicators that have syndicated content.
Like AP or Knight.
And if they see something that they say, hey, this is a nice story for our audience, and they put it in the paper, they put it on the radio, they put it on television. It's just that demand media has extended this concept and moved it into the internet. For me, the idea of I'll work for free and syndication of content are old stories, not new ones. It's just there's a new company doing it.
But what I think the issue, and it might be a philosophical one, and I'm not saying it's an issue that I have necessarily, but that some people raise, is that it's yes, it is those things, and that is a tried and true way of doing business and of content being produced, but that the ideas for these stories are coming based on user interest and SEO potential. And is there a risk of sort of that public interest factor in reporting or in journalism over time being lost if news is primarily produced based on what users say they're interested in, what they tell Google they're interested in, and what's going to return highest in the search results.
That's right. It's the age-old question of should you tell people what they want to know or should you tell people what they need to know?
Right. What do you think about that?
I think that's unanswerable. I think people will always spend the time to learn what they want to know. The job of a good media organization like this show is not to talk about what people want to know, but what the important issues are that they need to know about. And that's where I think journalists differ from consumers, is journalists try to bring the question of what's important as opposed to what's nice.
Alex, go ahead.
I think that, you know, this is an issue that, you know, we dealt with a lot in radio when I was programming a radio station, is that if you played all new stuff that you really wanted to push on people, they just stopped listening to your radio station. You had to play, you know, a lot of the old, you know, Creature Comforts, you know, the bands that everyone knew before, you know, and then you'd sprinkle in some new stuff every once in a while to kind of, you know, keep on moving them forward. But it is something that I think about a lot when I think about listening to NPR, which I listen to a lot, is that, you know, sometimes I feel like I get a richer experience by listening to it in the car when I'm just turning it on and listening to it, because I have to admit, when I go up to the NPR, my NPR app, I go through there and I delete, like, you know, 2/3 of the stories. Like, just on their face, I'm not interested in listening to them. Although when I actually get forced to listen to them, I'm like, oh, that was useful for me to know.
And you learn something that you otherwise wouldn't have been exposed to that you find is suddenly fascinating.
But I think a lot of this comes from the curation. So it's not a matter of who's generating the content. I don't think that's the biggest problem. It's how is it going to be curated, and how do you curate that much stuff? And I think that's going to be the big challenge that they're going to have, is how do you curate that much stuff effectively? And I don't, you know, I'll be surprised if they do it effectively. I think that's the...
It's interesting. I mean, I'm going to be curious to see how the folks at Gannett or Hearst and other places that do deals with demand and companies like that begin to apply some of their expertise. You know, can they bring to bear some of that curation, possibly, so that there is that mix that journalism has always been based on, you know, what you need to know and what you want to know. Because it's, you know, it's an interesting push-pull, and it's sort of a philosophical discussion. Speaking of traditional media, revenue at Viacom remains the same, but cost-cutting helps lift profit. I put this story in here. This is sort of what you need to know type of story. It's from the New York Times. I think it's good to kind of touch in every now and then on the earnings reports from traditional media companies, because we talk so much about these newer ventures, just to kind of get a reality check on what's going on there. Viacom reported roughly the same amount of revenue for the quarter ending in June, $3.3 billion, as it did in the quarter a year earlier, yet its profit rose almost 52% to $420 million, largely because of cost cutting. Obviously, you know, that cost cutting is occurring clearly because of, you know, the economy, and we're, you know, pulling out of that and everything. What I wanted to do with this story is use it kind of as a launching pad to talk about, you know, are there declining prospects for traditional media? I mean, the story also talks about how ad dollars are starting to come back. I mean, interestingly enough, the TV upfront was incredibly strong this year for traditional media. So I just thought this would be sort of an interesting conversation point. And Tim, I want to start with you on this, because I think you've got a great sense of the interplay between the two. You know, but when you look at sort of the big media companies like Viacom and News Corp and so on, you know, how are they doing? Are their prospects declining? Are they doing well? How are they positioned?
See, the key in doing this is you get rid of your albatross. You know, you get rid of the blockbuster and spin them off. They don't show up on your balance sheet, and then you're good. You look great. You know, I mean, times are tough, but the upfronts were good, and there's a lot of beachfront property right now that you can get at trailer park prices, and I think media companies are using that beachfront property to advertise their own products as well as make deals with other media companies, and it's got the dogs barking.
So, Alex, what do you think?
Well, I think that there is a challenge that, you know, I think that one of the things that's really affecting a lot of this is Netflix. I mean, when you look at, and also the DVR solutions. I mean, when you're able to either on your DVR or Netflix or TiVo or Apple TV or whatever, be able to watch full HD videos, the reason to buy DVDs and the reason to buy Blu-rays becomes, you know, less and less enticing. And I think that that's going to be a challenge, because that's kind of the long leader after the movie impact that they're kind of dealing with. I think that you know, that's going to be a challenge. I think that, you know, TV is going, it might be doing well right now, but I think a lot of that is also advertisers trying to take advantage of a perceived, you know, recovery in the U.S. economy, which may or may not occur this fall. So that, you know, that's an issue.
Larry, is the now we're kind of segueing into the upfront a little bit, but is the strength of the upfront, is it a false strength then? Is it sort of just a, you know, a perception like we have to bounce back and we have to get back in? Or does it say something about the strength or not of traditional TV?
Well, I think there's two ways to look at it. One is from the national, the network point of view, and the second is from the local station point of view. One of the things I was most interested in reading in this Viacom report is that their additional profit was attributed to an increase in affiliate fees and an increase in advertising revenues, which, as Alex and Tim were alluding to, says that advertisers are starting to slowly put their foot back in the water of traditional media, which is, I think, a good thing. But we're not seeing this yet trickle down to the local station, which is in just, it's, they're just in a world of hurt right now. And so the key, I think, is that this is, reading the entrails looks positive and that traditional advertisers are coming back into the market. But it is not yet enough that we can build a long-term plan on.
Now, speaking of local stations, I mean, this is such an interesting area to me, a fascinating area to me. And I'm curious what you guys think. Like, is there a future for local broadcast stations? I mean, we're talking about declining prospects or not of traditional media. For the local stations in particular, is it just sort of a slow path downhill? Or is there a sense that, you know, that they will do okay?
My sense is it really depends upon how the local station defines itself. If the local station defines itself as serving the local market, I think that there's hope. If they define themselves as simply a retransmitter of national programming, which means they have no identity separate from the network shows, then they're completely vulnerable to satellite and cable and network. But local stations for a long time have not treated their local market with the respect that it deserves, and I think many of them are in trouble because of it.
Alex, how do you view the prospects for local TV stations?
I think the challenge for local TV stations is that the infrastructure that they have set up was for an era that is gone. So they have a lot of gear, and they have a lot of people, and they have to convert that gear to, let's say, HD, which can be, you know, we're not talking about small amounts of money. We're talking about millions of dollars sometimes for a small station to improve its entire infrastructure. The issue is that does that really make sense? Are they really going to recoup that money? Can they really afford all those producers and reporters and all the other things that they have? And a lot of them need to start thinking about how do we, you know, pull that back a little bit. And there's a couple different ways of doing that. One is definitely making sure that they're streaming their local information online, because I think the future really for local video, local news coverage, is something that's more on your iPhone, on your iPad, on your, you know, like people watching some of that stuff. Like right now, I want to know about what the events are in Petaluma, and, you know, I want to, you know, watch little videos about what that looks like. I can't quite make it, and that hyper-local interest, but I don't know if I need to have a TV station to do that, to reach the people that I have there. The other option is something that was done in Canada, which is one of the things that Canadian Broadcasting got into, and I can't remember which network, but I'm pretty sure it was the CBC, is that they centralized their switching systems in Vancouver and then fibered to many of the local localities, where you have literally a handful of people sitting in a green screen room, and they're doing the local broadcast about local things, but also about the national stuff that's there. It's actually being switched and then rebroadcast from Vancouver. So, you know, it massively reduced and changed the pricing of the entire structure, which is something that, you know, might be something that can happen, where if you're not going to go hyper-local, you're going to have to do something where you actually, you know, externalize almost all of your costs, because there just isn't, you know, you need the hosts, a producer or two, and, you know, someone and an engineer, and then that's what local news is going to look like. You know, I think those are the two paths that I see.
Alex, I think we're already seeing a significant downsizing in local markets and local staff. I think that happened last year, that many of the stations have already downsized. The decision they need to make now is which market are they serving? Are they serving as a retransmission of the national shows, or are they going to start to develop the local area?
Right, and you're right, and I think it's a trend that we saw a big bump in last year, and it'll continue to go down that direction. And they either have to become local, hyper-local, covering the local high school football games and the local fairs and the local pieces and really becoming something that really gives you a sense of your community, or they should just give up because they can't compete on, you know, people gathering national and international news from online or the web.
Tim, maybe what they need, Tim, is a content farm.
I think the huge opportunity here for the local stations, I mean, they've always made their money off local news. That's where they've sold the local furniture commercials. That's where they've sold the local car dealership commercials. The huge opportunity here for them is mobile. If they can get that local news on the mobile devices, now they've increased their audience because you don't always have your TV in your pocket, but you do have your mobile phone. And if they can be getting people to opt in for news alerts about what's going on in their local area, if they can partner with like Foursquare so that there's news and information about the different stores that they're going in with sponsored links, I think that's a huge opportunity for the local TV stations.
And Netflix, let's segue to Netflix a little bit, and we're going to move on to another story. That this 28-day window seems to be working, interestingly enough. A paid content story says early agreements from Netflix and Redbox. Sorry, I was combining Blockbuster and Redbox to delay renting new titles until 28 days after they are first available for purchase in stores is already having positive results for Time Warner's film segment. That comes from CEO and Chairman Jeff Bukas at Time Warner. So basically, the company was able to take advantage of that, and releases for movies like The Blind Side and Sherlock Holmes sold more briskly than they might have otherwise. I don't think we have exact numbers yet on how significant an increase this is. But it's interesting, Alex, considering, you know, we talk a lot about DVD sales and sort of, you know, declining fortunes as well for DVDs and what's going to get people to buy them. Does this is one data point, let's keep that in perspective, but does this surprise you, or is this what you would have expected, Alex?
It surprises me. Who are these people? I mean, the thing is that... I mean, like, I just, you know, it's just like, I, you know, that whole there's a sucker born every minute, you know, really comes to mind. Because, I mean, it's just like, you didn't see it in the theater, you saw it in the theater, and you can't wait another 28 days to watch it. I mean, it's been out of the theaters for X number of months. It defies, you know, rational thought to buy something that's going to be available 30 days. I mean, if it's not, at this point, if it's not on DVR or Netflix or whatever, I just don't bother. I mean, I just, you know, I'm just going to wait for it, you know, I'm kind of like, I waited this long, I might as well just keep on waiting. And the thing is that if there's not a lot of extra features, if it's not like a Lord of the Rings or Star Wars style, I'm going to put all the behind the scenes stuff in there. There is no way I'm buying plastic. I mean, that's kind of where I've kind of gotten to. So,
Larry, what do you think? Do these numbers, does this surprise you or not?
I think Alex is just totally all wet. I mean, But that's a separate speech. I'm very old school. I have yet to rent a single movie. I buy everything that I have. But one thing I've learned is that the American consumer has zero impulse control. And so if it's available this instant, they're going to buy it. And if it isn't available, they're going to find some other way to get their hands on it. I think current trends in consumerism right now is there is no such thing as planning. It's all reacting. And the idea of having a window where something is not available in one store but available in a different store simply drives sales to that store. So I think windows make a great deal of sense if they're trying to make DVD sales work. And it doesn't surprise me at all that because it's not available for rent, people rush out and buy the DVD because nobody gives a thought to what's happening 30 days out.
You've never rented a movie?
No, I never have.
How often do you watch movies?
About every night.
And you buy them all?
Oh, yeah. You should see my collection.
Wow.
You should be on Cribs.
You're like the dream consumer for the movie studios. That's crazy. Really?
Well, yeah. I mean, how can you learn how to edit if you don't watch stuff? And how do you learn sound design if you don't watch stuff? To watch it once, that's consuming it. And, okay, great. There's a lot of movies that should only be watched once, and I would argue many don't deserve to be watched at all. But if you're going to spend your time and invest 2 or 3 hours of your life watching something, then let's get a good quality version. Let's take a look at it.
But now the reason you buy, though, is a business. It's not as a consumer that you're buying it. You're buying it as a business person who's in the editing business.
No, I confess, I will buy movies because I like to watch them.
There you go. See,
I have a few movies that I will not admit publicly that I watch. But I don't know. I've got several.
Oh, come on, one. Give us one of your guilty pleasures.
Daisy, you barely talk about anything except chocolate chip cookies. I'm not going to talk about movies with you.
All right, Tim, what's your guilty pleasure? No, seriously, though, this whole windowing strategy, where do you fall on it?
You want to know my guilty pleasure?
Maybe we don't want to know.
I kind of remember this 28 Days Later. It was like a British horror film by Danny Boyle. Where there was like this highly contagious rage virus, and it focused on the struggle of four survivors to cope with the ruining of the life they once knew. Do you guys remember that?
That's why we have Tim on the show, because he knows his zombie apocalypse stories.
Yeah, I think we live in a bubble, and I agree with Larry, and I agree with Alex. You know, there are people out there that still want to own, they still want to consume, and we haven't got to that point yet where the electronic sell-through has the same gratification that owning that DVD has. For all of us, Larry excluded, no offense, Larry, we're loving the Netflix streaming.
Yeah.
That's our thing. Although I have found it interesting that there are a lot of movies that go, oh, you know what? I want to see that movie. And I type it in, and it's an old movie, but it's not available for instant streaming. So that happens to me more often now than not, where I'm like, I want to watch Mad Men. Oh, I can only get Mad Men if I order the DVD from Netflix. So those are those frustrating moments that we're still dealing with here. But if the 28-day window is working, they're going to keep doing it.
I got to say, I'm in the Alex camp. I don't like owning additional things that I don't need. I'm all about just like cleaning things out. But yeah, I don't believe in plastic, in owning plastic when it comes to CDs or DVDs or anything like that. You know, I'd rather own it digitally, even if that means I could lose it, even if that means it could be erased or whatever. I like a certain bit of austerity. That's not the right word. I think it's something else, asceticism. Who knows? I'm getting those words all mixed up, which is embarrassing being a writer. So let's move on to TV tablets. Motorola and Verizon are said to be teaming up for a TV tablet, according to the Financial Times. Motorola is developing a digital tablet device that will let users watch TV on it. And Verizon is attempting to chip away at a market established by Apple's popular iPad. I didn't know that. Thank you. That was helpful. So this device is going to have a 10-inch screen and operate on Google's Android software. Could launch as early as the fall in the U.S. So this could tie into Verizon Fios's service. And I guess what's interesting is, Alex, how much room is there in the tablet market? We know, obviously, that you love your iPad. But when you look at the market overall, how much room is there and what are the additional features that you think consumers might want? Do they want to, if they're a Verizon customer, do they want to be able to get the Fios service on a tablet?
I think there's a massive market. I mean, I think that tablets in one form or another, whether it's the iPad or these tablets or Android tablets, I don't think it's that important, but I think that it is important to note that I think that something like the iPad is the future of consumer, computing. I mean, there's no reason for my kids, we've talked about this on the shows before, there's no reason for my kids or my parents to own anything other than an iPad. But when you look at their actual usage habits, they're just not using them to do the other stuff, and that platform is going to grow. And it's going to grow faster, I mean, with more, utility probably on the Android market as well. And so it won't be as easy to use, but it'll have a lot of other pieces. And I think that as people get, move further down that path, I think that is the future. And so I think that the growth market is massive, for the iPad. I think we're really at the very beginning when people were like, how many people are really going to buy iPods when they came out? Evidently hundreds of millions.
Yeah, more than any of us could have thought. And now Dish Network may be bringing live streaming as well to mobile devices. So, Larry, what do you think the appetite is to watch TV and sort of full-fledged TV on a mobile device. That's what I think is really potentially curious here. And of course, this Dish deal, this is a ZDNet story, says, you know, Dish streaming will be coming to iPads, iPhones, iPod touches, and Blackberries, as well as Androids. It's going to be kind of like a using Sling Media to bring your content to these devices. And I have to wonder, is it going to be hard or easy to use? And is this a duplication of a pay TV service? Do we want a duplication of a pay TV service on our mobile devices?
I hate to agree with Alex, but I think he is exactly correct.
Yay! I
think the future of computing for most everybody is going to be consuming content, not creating content. I think there's clearly going to be a need for computers which are designed for the creation, whether it's writing books or creating video. But that's not for the vast majority of the people that are going to be doing computing. If that's a true statement, then Alex is exactly right that what the iPad and other tablets offer is the future of computing. And I'm a big fan of letting history tell us what the future is going to be. If we take a look at the history of audio, look at how prior to the release of MP3 players, audio was a big deal that was consumed with giant expensive equipment and enjoyed sitting on a couch in the living room surrounded by expensive speakers and huge amplifiers filled with hot tubes and blinking lights. It was a geek heaven, but it was highly not portable. And people said, well, this is the highest possible quality that we can get. And people said, quality is not important. Portability is important. And the MP3 players totally changed the market. I think we're going to see the same thing. If I want to go see a movie in the theater where I watch it on an 80-foot screen, okay, I'm going to go do that. But the vast majority of my media consumption is not going to be watching a large screen. It's going to be watching it on a mobile device or watching it on a computer. A small screen for most content is more than adequate because most of the content we consume is you watch it once, it's disposable, you get the nugget of information you need, and you move on with your life. And I think Alex is exactly correct, is that people are voting that mobility and instant access to an unlimited amount of content is the wave of the future, and that means iPads. And the American consumer loves choices, which means that a Motorola iPad, though Motorola has stumbled severely since they released the Razr phone, we can't count them out. I think that there's going to be a number of people queuing up because this is where the market's going.
Tim, future of TV, future of tablets. How big, how much convergence between them?
Well, if you look at the history, like Larry says, the thing that accelerates it more than anything else is adult content. And I really think that since Apple has, you know, turned down any sexy apps, we're going to see an explosion. As much of an Apple fanboy as I am, Android is just going to skyrocket compared to the iPad because of the type of content that you can get a hold of, and the price points are going to be cheaper.
Portable porn.
That's it.
That's what it's all about. I think that's going to have to be the title of this week's episode. I want to touch on, we've got about 3 or 4 minutes left. So I just want to touch very briefly on Skype founders, the folks you know, who founded Skype, are launching a new online music service, One.com. This new project is going to have unlimited access to music, even without an internet connection. It's supposed to be a competition for Spotify, which is this music streaming service. It provides users with access to about 8 million songs through an entire sound library. Alex, you're so good and steeped in the music business. Does this have potential?
You know, I think Spotify has been very successful, in the areas that it's been available, and I think that it could be. I like a lot of these things. I still have to admit that I'm kind of in this thing where I have a couple devices that are just chock full of music, and I just find myself not really as interested in a lot of these music plays as I was a couple years ago. I mean, I have kind of all the music I can handle. And so I think, that's going to be the challenge is are there enough people who want to keep on doing that? And they missed the boat. This coming out 10 years ago would have been revolutionary. This coming out now?
Maybe not as much. And I'm sorry, I gave the wrong name. I was actually quoting the site that I got it from. The name of it is RDIO. I don't know if that's supposed to be radio or how it's pronounced. But anyway, that's the name of the project. Larry, what do you think?
You know, I think that we are seeing the complete devaluation of music. That in the past, people would get passionate about the music And now music becomes like this valueless wallpaper. If you can't get it for free, it's not worth getting. And I think that from an artist point of view and from a creator point of view, there's no value in working in the industry because there's no market there. And I'm curious to see how this new online music service, which, to be quite truthful, I hadn't heard of before this week, how this is going to play out, because music is ubiquitous, it's valueless, and as Alex said, you know, it doesn't light anybody's candles anymore.
Tim.
You know, I once heard a digital media guru say that when you're first starting out in the business, you want to get a job. And you don't care if that job's for free or not. You just want the exposure. You want the experience. So for new musicians,
a brilliant statement, by the way. I don't know who you heard that from, but a man of insight, I'm sure.
I think this is a huge opportunity for them. For everybody else, I think this is going to be as big as Juiced was.
Ooh.
Without the video.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's Skype's wonderful, but Juice didn't really pan out so well. So on that note, it looks like we are near the end of the show. I just want to remind our listeners to friend us up on Facebook. We, of course, have a TWIM Facebook page, facebook.com/pages/thisweekinmedia. Alex, where can we find you online?
You can find me on the Twitters, Alex Lindsay, all one word, or you can check out. We're doing a lot of coverage of SIGGRAPH coming up. We're relaunching a show called Inside the Black Box, so you can find that at pixelcore.tv.
Excellent. And Tim, where can people find you?
You can read my blog at onetimstreet.com or check us out at mdialogue.com.
And Larry Jordan, tell us where we can track you down.
There's three places. I've got a brand new website called the number two, tworealguys.com, which looks at creative storytelling without talking about technology. Brand new. We've also got our weekly podcast, which doesn't have anywhere near as cute a co-host, Daisy, as yourself, but it's digitalproductionbuzz.com. And for people that want to learn more about Final Cut, it's larryjordan.biz, larryjordan.biz.
Excellent. And if you're looking for me, Daisy Whitney, you can find me at daisywhitney.com and Daisy Whitney on Twitter. This mess you've been listening to was recorded on August 10th, 2010. We are over and out.
This Week in Media is a PixelCore.tv production produced by Suzanne Llewellyn with technical producers John Riley and Alutha Jamankar. Content contributor is Jason Perrier.